You got a calendar?
Yeah, there we are. Today is the 16th of July, 1981, and this is a... Well, it's not quite an interview with Air Marshal Dunlap. Actually, this tape contains replies to a number of questions posed to Air Marshal Dunlap by Dr. Alec Douglas of the Directorate of History in letters, file reference 1325-3 DHIST, March 18, 1981, and April 23, 1981. Now, if I may, Air Marshal Dunlap, I will ask you to address a few general remarks to this series of questions pertaining to aircraft procurement and RCAF post-war planning. Then I will follow up with some of Alec's queries.
Very good, Reds. And some of my remarks here will be addressed to Alec, since this tape is eventually going to him, and some to you. But here I want to say, Alec, first of all, I must warn that I may be somewhat rambling, as this is being undertaken with a minimum of advanced preparation. Also, I would like to say that as your questions in large part relate to my influence and my thoughts on aircraft procurement for the RCAF, I feel I must provide a bit of background in order that you may better understand my credentials, or lack of them, for the part I played in this regard. First of all, at the outset of my flying career, which started in 1928, I had experience on both British and U.S. aircraft. At the outset, my training in 1928 was on the Avro 504N, a British aircraft, World War I vintage, Armstrong Siddeley Lynx engine. I think generally regarded at that time as a very good training aircraft. The engine, however, likewise good in the environment for which it was designed, it was a bit troublesome at times in Canada, in the wintertime, in the summertime, through also through icing in the carburetor, and was subject to forced failure and therefore forced landings. I was a victim of a few of these. The next aircraft I flew, a Vedette, a Canadian design, was engined with the same links. And it also let me down at rather a northerly remote point way up in northern Manitoba when I was ferrying a new Vedette from the factory in Montreal, the Vickers factory in Montreal, out to northern a point on the Hudson's Bay Railway. So I sort of been formulating one's views of U.S. versus American equipment. I suppose you might say that there's one or two strikes up already against that British engine. Unfairly, because it was really because it's improper adaptation, perhaps, to the Canadian environment. Next, I flew a Moth, Gypsy Moth, DH-60. For a while, not very long, but it was a British design, manufactured in Canada. Very sweet little aircraft, and created a pleasant reaction in my mind. But for several years thereafter, I was on Fairchild. That was my first association with U.S. designed aircraft. The Fairchild was, I suppose you might describe it as a light transport, adapted for photographic survey work. And although I operated all over Canada, my principal experience on that was out here in the Rockies up in B.C. And for 4 years, that Pratt & Whitney Wasp engine never failed or faltered. That, of course, gave me a slight bias, I think, towards U.S. equipment, because there are many dicey moments out here, and an engine failure would have been quite serious. then I'm working up towards 1935. I'm recovering the span between 28 and 35. In 34, I had a fair amount of experience on two other American types, the Consolidated Courier. I think you would call it a training type, but it was adapted for aerial gunnery. And also the Fleet Fawn, an American type, manufactured, I think, in Canada, but American design. Both of those were first-class machines and purpose being used, and created a good impression in my balance sheet of U.S. versus American type, the U.S. versus British type. Then I had some experience on the Siskin, Armstrong Whitworth Siskin. It was a fighter aircraft. We used it while I was flying it for air-to-ground gunnery training. It was also used in the RCF for aerobatics and aerobatic demonstrations and so on in formation. It was a fine little aircraft in its day, although it was getting obsolete by this time. I think that my love for it suddenly dissipated, though, on one occasion when, after I had just landed, one of my officers took it up, and 15 minutes later it exploded in the air, and we have never discovered the reason why, but something went wrong in that engine, and I suppose something failed in the engine, and the thing just tore itself apart. So, you know, such is an engine seizure. Yeah. So, I think up to that point, maybe my leanings were a little bit more favoring American equipment than the British. Then, of course, I got on to my first really nice military British aircraft design, and that was the Hawker Audax, brought out primarily for cooperation with the Army. And although it was still a biplane, we were still in the biplane era, really, but it was the neatest, smoothest, cleanest biplane design that I'd seen so far, and it was my first exposure to the Rolls-Royce engines in aircraft, and it had the Rolls-Royce Kestrel in it. And that was a very happy combination, and I thought that was the first nice aircraft. Now, I'm going into all this detail because I'm trying to indicate my feelings for American versus British. From 1935 to 1939, I spent all but 11 months in the UK flying with the Royal Air Force on during the time that I was taking the advanced armament and ballistics courses. Really, I was taking armament engineering. In the course of that training, I was engaged, and along with my fellow students and compatriots, in a lot of gunnery, bombing, and exercises, air to ground, air to air, and so on. And the aircraft that we flew, first of all, the Bristol Bulldog, and it was a little bit obsolete at 535. Exposed to it, but it was a nice little fighter aircraft. It was a good example of a RAF fighter. It was soon to be replaced by the Hawker Fury, and it was very similar to the Audax, but brought out primarily to meet the requirements of fighter squadrons. The Hart was another variant, a fighter bomber. And so also was the Hind. Those were all Hawker designs, all, if my memory serves me right, engined by the Rolls-Royce Kestrel, and all very pleasant to fly. The one aircraft in that time period that I disliked heartily, and which I flew a fair amount on because we did our bombing. Well, we did certain gunnery exercises from it because it did have a scarf ring on which was mounted the machine gun. But it also was designed for bomb aiming and bombing practices in the bomb range, and that was the Walker.
Westland Wapiti.
How do you spell that?
Westland Wapiti. Wapiti is the animal. W-A-P-I-T-I. It had been a fairly good aircraft in its day, I suppose. It was World War I vintage. Re-engined by Westland. And name changed to Wapiti. And it served the RAF out in the Northwest Frontier and places like that, and also in Iraq and Palestine and whatnot, and operating against the Arabs, I guess it was, and the natives out there in Afghanistan, I guess it was a fairly effective machine. But as a flying vehicle, it left an awful lot to be desired. I could say some pretty strong words about that machine.
I just didn't like it.
So there are a few of the aircraft that I was familiar with up until 1939. Now, I might mention that one's familiarity with aircraft in those days also was gained through very careful perusal of trade journals, like the airplane, if you can call it a trade journal, and flight in the UK, and aviation, and other journals in the US. I think it was early enough in the flying game that one tended to read and study every new aircraft that came out, and they were reported on in minute detail in these journals. So, aviation airplane, I guess it was called, not aviation, airplane and flight in the UK would analyze every aspect of an aircraft, of a new type coming out, and as it was developed and modified it. And you got a great deal of familiarity with those types in that through that means, even though perhaps you didn't have an opportunity to fly them. One's interest in aviation is such that you followed most carefully the things such as the Snyder Trophy races. And Britain was very much involved in that, and indeed was the winner of the trophy 3 years running, along about the late 20s and early 30s, and that Snyder Trophy design, that aircraft that was designed by Supermarine, and the winner of that race was the forerunner of modern fighter aircraft. It was a beautiful streamlined monoplane in the days when monoplanes were just coming into use in the military services. It was a seaplane, of course. It was designed by the chap who designed the Spitfire. And it was definitely the forerunner of the Spitfire. It demonstrated the value of these competitions. And it demonstrated the great aid that some of the wealthy philanthropists provided in sponsoring and financing some of these operations. Snyder Truck races never would have come Britain's way if one of those very wealthy sportswomen hadn't backed it and financed it. Certainly the government wouldn't. So I got familiar with the designers, because I was fascinated by the Snyder Trophy designs, and later with the Spitfire, through my work on the ballistics and armament course that I was involved in the UK. We went and visited the factories where the Spitfire was being manufactured, and also the Hurricane. We were interested particularly in their gunnery arrangements. They were the first aircraft to come out with 8 machine guns. This was something absolutely new and novel, never unheard of, because up to that time nobody ever put more than 2 guns in the fighter, in the British forces anyway, and I can't recall more than that being on a fighter in any other force to that day. My group, and we were 3 students on this ballistics course, did a lot of
study under our famous Professor Cunningham on the optimum arrangement of the guns and the focusing of the guns, if you like, because as they went out the wing, mm-hmm. further and further out the wing, they had to be brought to bear at the optimum point forward of the aircraft to give the best distribution and the best, greatest probability mm-hmm. of destroying the enemy aircraft on first burst.
To get it in a cold.
And of course we were involved also with the harmonization of the guns and the gun sight to bring things to bear at the right point. We did a great deal on work on that, and it was all extremely tedious because it was before the days of computers, and we were working out these things longhand under the theory of probability was the best optimum. Right. So that brought us closely into touch with both the Spit and the Hurricane in the days even before they were test flown. Perhaps also in the early days of the test flight program. I mention that because I gained first-hand knowledge of these forthcoming fighters and a tremendous admiration for the design and the manufacture of both those machines. So I was a great backer of these forthcoming British aircraft, ever more promising, in the fighter class. Mm-hmm. Then I think I should mention also one other thing that has some bearing on my subsequent recommendations about suitable aircraft for the RCF, and that is that during those years of exposure, during the whole period from 1935 to 1939, to the summer of 39, or spring of 39, when I became a headquarters officer, during the whole period, I was not only engaged in flying these various military aircraft, but as a pilot, but I was engaged extensively as an air gunner and as a bomb aimer, and studying them from the point of view of their suitability in those roles. That, I think, gave me a certain breadth of knowledge that many other pilots in the service did not have. I knew the problems of the bomb aimer, of the navigator, and of the air gunner, and so on. I knew all about the new designs of gun turrets that were in the offing, and we went regularly to visit the development centers where the gun turrets were being designed. And the gun turrets were new at that stage, too. There had not been a power-operated gun turret in any British aircraft up until just before the war, shortly before the war. But in 37, for example, and 38, companies like Fraser Nash, the great famous racing car manufacturer, and who had a remarkable design team, and he himself was a terrific inventor, they were in the forefront of developing the gun turret. So we saw a good deal. Yeah.
Can I ask a question here? You would be naturally a Canadian in the Canadian Air Force. Was there any question of security with respect to your seeing and dealing and being so aware of the most up-to-date modern designs of the British aircraft?
No, none whatsoever. There was a three of us on this advance course, and we were cleared for this sort of equipment. There might have been something conceivable that might have been excluded from from my eyes, but I was unaware of anything like that. And certainly there was nothing in this area we're talking about now. They were completely free with their information. That's enough of that to give a broad picture of my credentials. I'm going to mention a few more aircraft that I became familiar with during the war in a moment, but I want to say at this moment that I've been talking about my experience as a comparatively junior officer in the Air Force and a comparatively active officer in the Air Force. I've been doing a great deal of flying through these years that we're speaking of. Yet, my superiors say up at the level of decision making, at the Air Council level, for example, and many of their senior staff officers below them, unfortunately, they had not been flying for many years. They were all World War I pilots. Because so many of them were involved in staff appointments, they just were not getting out into the air. That was sad, but true. And maybe it was because fine pay was, at that time, granted whether you flew or not. In later years, you had to put in your flying time in order to qualify for flying pay. But in those days, you didn't. And a human being is a little bit lazy, as you know, and to get away from... the opportunity wasn't always there. And when you're at headquarters in Ottawa, for example, it was a bit of an effort to get out someplace and get an aircraft to fly. There were aircraft at Rockliffe outside Ottawa, but they were all designated for some specific purpose, and they were all engaged in that. So they weren't readily available headquarters officers, and I suppose that's one reason that this developed. But every one of the members of the Air Council in that time frame, 1939 onwards, when they were having to make decisions about the most suitable aircraft for the RSF, they hadn't flown for years. Now, I have a feeling that they tended to put too much credence and weight on the opinions of a chap like myself. They looked upon some of us as experts. Well, we hadn't flown all the... I had to flown a fair number of types, but my experience wasn't broad enough to really qualify me as an expert in recommending a certain design or not. And furthermore, I was, by this time, a specialist officer. I was an armament officer. When I was asked about my opinions on aircraft, I tended to reply more in relation to its armament capability, to its offensive and defensive capability, than I was insofar as its other qualifications. Its flying qualifications are concerned. I always felt that my immediate superior on the Air Council, and that was Pat Cuff, Air Vice Marshal Cuff. He was sort of mesmerized in a way by the fact that I had spent all these years over there in the RAF and that I was highly qualified in armament. He'd never had an opportunity to do something like that. And, I think I always felt he put too much weight on my opinion. He was not a person to be easily swayed, but he had his favorites, and he tended to if I said such and so and so, he tended to go up to their council and push that point of view. Perhaps a bit more than he did from some of his other fellows. Now, for example, and also I had worked under Bredner before I worked under Cuff. And Bredner, who was, by this time was the chief of the air staff, Bred was, I think, that's a bit better. Forget the lawnmower noises. Bred paid a good deal of attention to my advice because, again, he felt that I had had quite a broad training during that period. I, on the other hand, didn't feel that I had the background to carry the weight that they were giving my views. However, and in the case of Bredner, for example, he was in England in 30. God, I've forgotten. Yeah, I guess it was 35. He was over there on a course for a year at Staff College. And he was, from time to time, given certain assignments while he was there, investigating certain aircraft that might be procured for the RCS. And on one occasion, one Sunday, he invited the few RCF officers who were in England at the time to come and join him for a drink. He wanted to get some information, but he was also being social and friendly at the time. He asked me what I thought of the Wapiti. And I told him in no uncertain terms, I don't think I've ever spoken more strongly about the unsuitability of an aircraft. Now, he remonstrated with me for being so outspoken about an RAF machine that I had the privilege of flying. But I also sort of had the feeling that he was wishing that he had asked that question a little bit earlier. That was a feeling I got, a reaction I got. And he said nothing at the time, but I discovered some weeks or maybe months later that just 10 days earlier he had signed a contract for the Air Ministry to acquire Wapitis for the RCAF.
Just one?
Wapitis.
Yes, but how many did
you have? Oh, enough to equip a squadron. And, of course, they were obtained at bargain prices, and Canada didn't really have much money in those days to buy aircraft, so I guess that was one reason he went for this obsolete machine. The RAF was phasing them out. We could get them for nothing, frankly. But by the time they'd been refurbished in Canada after that, they were dismantled and shipped and refurbished and the rust removed. Cost damn near as much as it would. We could have almost bought a new aircraft for the price. So, that was a near miss. If I'd been a week or two earlier, I think I could have influenced. Just before we wind this up, this background, I think that I should make reference to attitudes. Now, I was struck that during the time I was in serving with the RAF, or I should say associated with the RAF, that they had, I guess it was a natural nationalistic point of view, but they had a great disdain for any types designed and manufactured in foreign countries. And a disdain for U.S. aviation. They didn't feel that the U.S. had amounted to anything in military design. I think they were prepared to admit by then that they were doing pretty well in the civil aviation field, but there was still this feeling that Britain is superior. They had almost a contempt for anything that Canada designed. We hadn't designed very much up to that. Not interested in Canadian effort, and I don't think that they thought Canada could do very much. We were still the colony. We hadn't become, in the eyes of most of those people that I made contact with, they hadn't become an independent nation yet. You probably would count that attitude yourself. And also, another thing I encountered that I might mention is we're on this subject is there was a great tendency on the part of the average RAF officer, and particularly the Staff College trained RAF officer, to assume that in time of war Canada would automatically just fall in line with the British forces and that there would be a Commonwealth Air Force, not an RCAF. The Commonwealth Airport, more or less the way there was in World War I, where Canadians just, the air crew just came over and served with the Royal Air Force. Yeah. That was the picture that they had in their mind, and it was the thing that they advocated. That was the way to handle things. That would be the best organizational arrangement in future war. And, I encountered that time and again. I think it colored my thinking a good deal because I didn't go along with it. And it made me perhaps a little bit more sympathetic to Canada's Canadian invasion, Chubby Powers, Canadian and Canada's Canadian invasion efforts to build not only Canadian squadrons but Canadian formations overseas.
Did you try and convert them?
I didn't make much dent in that. I think I tried, but there wasn't very much that one could do. Now, just to wind up the matter of aircraft, I think before we leave this, I should mention that in the early years of the war, I did have a fair amount to do with aircraft like the Ferry Battle, the Bristol Bolingbroke, which was the Canadian variation of the Bristol Blenheim, which the RAF went to war in the first stages of the war. It was the light bomber. The Avro Anson and the Weston White Lysander. They were fairly useful for the purpose. We used those four types in the British Commonwealth Air Training Plan at the bombing gunnery schools, and I had a great deal to do with the bombing gunnery schools as they more or less came under my umbrella as director of armament. Mm-hmm. They came under the umbrella of the director of training in a general sense, but in a particular sense under mine. Yeah. And then during the war years, I just mentioned, to round out this picture of my flying association with military aircraft, during the war years, I was intimate with the Halifax heavy bomber, 400 heavy bomber, with the Wellington, which was the twin-engined bomber, with the Mitchell. I had perhaps more experience with the Mitchell than anything else. That was the first two were British types. The Mitchell was an outstanding American light bomber. That was the type of aircraft that Jimmy Doolittle threw off the carrier in his attack against Tokyo and on to crash land in China. And then finally the Lancaster, my last assignment over there during the war years. I had 80 Lank 10s, so the latest Lancasters, and they were made in Canada. Lank 10 was the Canadian Lank. So, there's the introduction. So,
can I interject at this point? I understand that in 1940 you supported the Bell P-39 for use in Canadian fighter squadrons in the home war establishment. Why?
Well, I must first of all caution that my recollections on that subject are none too clear. It's a long way back, and but I'll give you my thinking as best I can. The P-39 and the P-40 were two types that appeared to be suitable for RCF use. And this, I'm talking about RCF use at home. There was a need to provide fighter squadrons to protect the installations on the Atlantic and the Pacific seaboard, and for some special installations inland, for example, the works, aluminum works in Arvida. Mm-hmm. Arvida at that time was providing practically all of the aluminum that was used in Britain and the United States and in Canada. It was therefore a pretty vital point. And if the Germans, by a suicide raid, and they had certain aircraft that could have made that one-way mission, had gone in there and blown that place up, it would have been pretty serious. So it was decided that that was a category of target inland that should be protected. So there was some legitimate need for fighter squadrons in Canada. I never got too excited about the threat. And I always felt that there were too many fighter squadrons provided. But nonetheless, the politicians were pressing, and we had to provide protection for the Army and the Navy on the coastal areas and certain other military installations there. But in 1940, and we're talking that period, 1940 and 41, aircraft were extremely difficult to come by. The Americans were suddenly beginning to awaken and build up their own force. So the British were anxious to get as much assistance as they could, and they had procurement missions over there in the States trying to buy up aircraft left, right, and center. The Canadian need was, to some extent, legitimate, but not terribly urgent, in my opinion. The politicians probably thought otherwise. Mm-hmm. But at any rate, I was inclined to look at this more from the point of view of what I felt we could expect to acquire, not perhaps what was the most desirable. I would have been happy to have seen the P-40. I didn't think we had a hope of getting the P-40 because the Americans were buying it up, the British were buying it up, and everything was heavily committed. Mm-hmm. And our need was pretty immediate. I was asked an opinion about the P-39. Now, I would presume, although Allie Douglas has papered on this, I presume, a memorandum on file, that the question put to me related more to its armament than to its suitability as a fighter aircraft. But it may be that my boss asked me to recommend on both aspects. The P-39, the Bell Air Cobra, had very unusual armament. It had a machine gun, a cannon firing through the hub of the prop. Nothing. It was the first, I guess, of the aircraft on the Allied side to contemplate the use of a cannon. Many others used it later on, and it had machine guns in the wings and so on. And I think they were 50 caliber machine guns, and that was some heavier than anything that we'd been using. So I was very tempted. I was very taken with the P-39 because of its armament. I was a realist, I think, and I recommended perhaps on it also by virtue of the fact that I felt it might be the one that would be available to the RCF. Mm-hmm. No sense trying to hang on and get a P-40 that weren't going to be available. But I should say that as the director of armament, my recommendation should have been more allied to akin, aligned with the armament than with the other characteristics, because my boss, Pat Cuff, would look to the director of operations, one of my sister directors, for recommendations on the suitability of the aircraft. I'm sure he probably asked both of us. Maybe he took the sum of our opinions and went to Air Council with those opinions. Now, there was an awful lot of shilly-shallying, dilly-dallying back and forth as time went on between the P-39 and the P-40. I don't know what was behind the hesitation in decision-making on this, but I know it went on for a long time before. Eventually, we were, situation changed, and we were allocated P-40s on production line. And those, a number of P-40 squadrons did come into being. The P-39 never came our way, notwithstanding the fact that I recommended very strongly. I think Alex feels that if I hadn't made the strong recommendation, maybe we would have got the P-40 a little earlier. I don't know. I just can't remember well enough. And as things worked out, the P-40, which is the Kitty Hawk, was mainly used on the Pacific Coast here, in fighter squadrons. Yes. And in due course, after the Battle of Britain had passed and the situation, the fighter aircraft situation in Britain improved, we did get some Hurricanes. And we got a fair number of Hurricanes. And Hurricane equipped the fighter squadrons on the Atlantic coast. There were some variations, mm-hmm. exceptions to this. But generally speaking, the Hurricane, the Mark II Hurricane was found on the Atlantic coast and the, mm-hmm. and the Kitty Hawk out here on the West Coast.
Right.
So there you are.
Now, would you have been happy with the Hurricane or the Spitfire for use in Canadian home war establishment squadrons in 1940 and thereafter?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. They, both the Hurricane and the Spit, in my estimation, were top-notch fighter aircraft. The Spit, particularly. But in the time frame that we're talking about, when I was recognizing P-39, we were sort of in the Battle of Britain days, yeah. and one just dismissed the thought of getting anything of that nature from Britain. It wasn't until sometime later, as new types of Hurricanes and new types of Spits came into service in the RAF, that there was possibility of getting some of the earlier Spits. That's mm-hmm. one reason we guess we got the Hurricane II. Production had increased tremendously in Britain, and they could afford to let us have some Hurricanes, and they were moving to more advanced types of Hurricane anyway. So,
can I interject here again, and this shows my own ignorance, but did we get these prior to Pearl Harbor? Because once the Japanese had attacked, of course, this would be another great demand for them.
Well, as a matter of fact, we didn't. I think it was after Pearl Harbor that we got the Kitty Hawks. And we had the offer for Kitty Hawks before Pearl Harbor, but I think it was after Pearl Harbor that we got them.
Yeah.
And I guess by that time the American production had begun to increase sharply. And they, of course, were interested in continental defense after Pearl Harbor, and I guess as much as Halifax, for example, was a big convoy center for both of U.S. and Canadian shipping,
mm-hmm.
they would be anxious to have some fighter defenses available in those areas, Halifax and Sydney and St. John and so on, St. John, Newfoundland, St. John. That would tend to loosen things up a bit. So.
Yeah.
We actually did get to it. I guess that's all I can say on that one.
Were there other aircraft procurement programs on which you had an influence during the war?
Well, I don't think there are any that I had a major influence on. I had an input on one or two, as far as one or two types are concerned. For example, I went down to the U.S. in October of 1941. In company with, I think it was Wing Commander Orr and Wing Commander Hurley. And we went to visit the Naval Center and Naval Command in Norfolk.
Mm-hmm. What was your own rank at this time?
I was a Wing Commander.
A Wing Commander?
Yeah, right. You're all Wing Commander. Mm-hmm. I became Group Captain a lot later than that, but I was a Wing Commander. And we had been at Mitchell Field. I think we went down to Mitchell Field to participate in some maneuvers, and then from there we went on to Norfolk to see the Catalina the Consolidated Company Flying Boat. And I was particularly interested in the armament on this machine and what it could handle in the way of bombs and depth charges and things like that. Because we were interested in the Catalina. I think that I was quite enthusiastic and impressed with the possibilities of the Catalina, and they were talking at that time of making it amphibious under the name of the Canso. It operated as an amphibian, and under the name of Catalina, I guess it operated just as a flying boat.
Yeah.
And in due course, we got quite a number of those in the RCF, and I know that my report on it was favorable, but to what extent that had any influence on its procurement, I can't say, because I know a number of other people reported favorably on it, too. The other aircraft that I saw on that particular trip, and perhaps should mention, that was the Martin B-26. It was a light bomber. It was a sister in a way of the B-25 that I was so familiar with, the Mitchell.
Mm-hmm.
It was a little hotter, higher wing loading and so on than the B-25. And indeed, in its early form, the U.S. Air Force used quite a number of these during the war, but in its early form, the wing loading was too damned high and it tended to get wingtip stall and be a little awkward at a critical point in takeoff and landing. So I know that my views on that were not very favorable, and we never did get involved with that aircraft. I perhaps was influenced more by the information on that I got from the Canadian Air Attaché in Washington, who was with us. He joined us, too. I should have mentioned that. That was Wing Commander John Bryan. He joined us at Mitchell Field in New York, and then went down to Norfolk and so on. And he was pretty knowledgeable on these things, and I think his view was that the B-26 was to be avoided at the present time until it was modified. So I may have had a little bit of influence there. As a matter of fact, one thing that I had quite a major input on didn't have to do with procurement of aircraft for the RCAF, but rather for the RAF. I think you're aware that at one stage during the war I was commanding a Royal Air Force day bomber wing,
mm-hmm.
and we were flying Mitchells, and I had been on Mitchells for quite a long time, and it was a very suitable aircraft for the type of operations we were doing, but Britain some 2 years earlier had laid down a specification for an aircraft to fill the same role that the Mitchell was filling. And Bristol had been working on it and been manufacturing it, and the time arrived when it had been test flown, and